And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. It's approaching 4 minutes past nine. It's just turned 4 minutes past nine on this Tuesday, the 18th of November. And you're very welcome along to the 9 to noon show. How you're keeping? I do hope you're very well indeed. And it's great to have you on board. And probably have a few new listeners if you're due in to work at 9 o'clock. The traffic is a nightmare in and around Letterkenny again this morning. So maybe if you are due in to work at nine, you're getting a little sneak peek of the 9 till noon show. It's good to have you on board. Stay patient, folks. Okay, the lines are open for you. 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number. 086 60 25,000, or you can give us a call on 074 91 25,000. If you want to comment via email, it's comments@highlandradio.com. And don't forget to watch the show if it suits you. If you're at home or working from home, we're on the smart TV or the Fire Stick or your Google devices. Just search out the YouTube app, and we're also across Facebook and on the X platform. So listen, just no excuses. Listen, watch, whatever. Or read, actually. The YouTube and Facebook page has AI-generated subtitles. So if you are hard of hearing or someone in your life is, it might be an opportunity for you to stay up to date with what's happening in your area visually. Right, let's look at the newspapers. The Irish Times this morning, and the PSNI to investigate alleged abuse in Presbyterian Church. This is a story I mentioned yesterday, but the police and Gardaí have confirmed that they are taking this issue very seriously. A dedicated team of senior detectives in the Police Service of Northern Ireland is to lead a criminal investigation into abuse allegations within the Presbyterian Church of Ireland. Discussions have also taken place with An Garda Síochána, as there may be victims in the Republic, the PSNI said. At a press conference in Belfast, PSNI Assistant Chief Constable David Beck said a small number of victims had come forward. That is so far, of course. However, he said the scale of the investigation could be quite significant. Last week, the moderator of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, Reverend Trevor Gribben, resigned over a failure to deal adequately with child protection issues. A report by the church's safeguarding team identified a number of situations between 2009 and 2021, with one as late as 2022, where we have failed to deliver adequate safeguarding services. Now, the one thing that's not clear at this point is exactly the nature of the instances that are being investigated, when that information became available, etc. There seems to be, quite remarkably, in a church in this day and age, quite a lack of oversight in terms of safeguarding within the Presbyterian Church and what have you. So I'm not really quite sure at this point what the allegations are. No one is, because the Presbyterian Church itself is not commenting, and neither the Gardaí or police have indicated if this is relating to adults or to children, or what actually the nature of the abuse is. Reading on here, that it involved three Presbyterian congregations on both sides of the border. Now, I'm not sure even if it's appropriate to say, but maybe it is, maybe it isn't. If you have information in relation to that, obviously your first port of call is An Garda Síochána or the PSNI, depending on where you're listening to us. But if there is any information you think would be useful for us as well, of course, please feel free to get in touch. 086 60 25,000. There's huge overspending in the HSE at the moment. When I say overspending, there is funds allocated to employ people directly. Those jobs aren't being filled. So over 700 million euro has been spent on agency workers, and this is to fill or to cover jobs that have yet to be filled. The HSE is on course to spend more than 720 million euro hiring agency workers this year, while not filling more than 3,700 staff jobs for which it has funding. Agency workers cover a wide range of services and are hired daily to provide medical and nursing care, administrative duties, as well as general support and other patient care. However, 3,743 full-time jobs that could be filled under the HSE budget are vacant, raising major questions about the efficient use of public money and about disruptions to patients' care with different people on duty. So I presume, and it is a choice, is it? And pardon my ignorance in this area. I presume people who are qualified in these elements of care given have chosen to work for agencies rather than the HSE directly. I presume that is a choice you make. So you could say, right, I could go for one of the 3,700 jobs which are available that match my my need, my education, etc. Or I could go to agencies. And I presume the agencies pay more, do they? Or they have better better working conditions or better hours or what have you. So how do you ever fix that problem? Because presumably, again, a moment of correction, the HSE is competing for the same staff as agencies is, but when it loses, it ends up playing, employing those staff through the agencies anyway. So what needs to change in how the HSE employs people directly to make it more attractive? But I think then those wheels move really slowly because every single element of work within the HSE or any public job is sort of linked to another. And if you were to try and increase conditions in one space, then the unions might say, well, what about our workers? We also need to have the situation improved. And I wonder if that's part of the problem as to why we don't ever see any progress in this area. But clearly people are choosing to work for agencies rather than the HSE directly, and then are getting employed by the HSE. And I presume then that's why we have to look overseas and bring overseas workers in as much, because then we can offer them direct employment and pathways to, I don't know, staying here, for an example, if that's what they want to do. And is that why we sort of see this employment model? If you've got an insight into that also, let me know. I'm just presuming that that must be the case, because these people are working for the agencies anyway, but they end up working for the HSE. The comprehensive data was released to Social Democrat Health spokesperson Parig Rice after he put a series of questions to Health Minister Jennifer Carroll McNeill. On to the Irish Daily Mail now, and it's more expense. They've looked at the numbers in terms of immigration. The Irish Daily Mail focused quite a lot on immigration or migration. And more than 1.1 billion euro has been spent on accommodating asylum seekers and Ukrainian refugees in the first three quarters of this year. An analysis by the Irish Daily Mail of a database compiled by Fianna Fáil TD Albert Dolan shows the state has spent almost 7 billion euro accommodating asylum seekers and Ukrainian refugees since 2012, so 7 billion over 13 years. It comes as Minister for Justice Jim O'Callaghan said that Irish laws may have to change in light of a seismic shift in immigration policy in the United Kingdom. And I'll go into a little bit more detail on that part of that story in the Irish Daily Star. Asylum seekers will not view Ireland more favourably than the UK, according to aims set out by the Justice Minister. Jim O'Callaghan made the commitment after the UK Home Secretary announced sweeping changes designed to reduce the UK's attractiveness to asylum seekers. Mr O'Callaghan said these could result in changes to the flow of asylum seekers between the UK and Ireland. And in a statement today, he will say, I am committed to ensuring that Ireland is not viewed more favourably than the UK by those seeking to claim asylum. Consequently, I will closely monitor the changes proposed by the UK government and will respond to those proposals, having considered them fully and discussing them with colleagues. So that won't happen until later in the year, because there's a new bill coming in later in the year, and he says that that will be included in that. So yesterday in Britain, Miss Mahmood, she is the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, she said that the UK's current asylum system is out of control and unfair, as she announced reforms aimed at deterring illegal immigration. She talked of communities being destabilised because of high numbers of people coming into an area all at one time. She also referenced the fact that the country was getting more angry, and that anger could turn into hatred. Was one of the states, and she said. So what are they going to do? I briefly listened last night as I was going to sleep, stuff along the lines of not being able to get citizenship for 20 years and other measures. And that means that there are those in Britain at the moment who might say, right, we need to go somewhere else, like very close, i.e. Ireland, where you can get the citizenship, etc., much easier. Donald Trump's made a U-turn and is now urging Republicans to vote to release the Jeffrey Epstein case files, as he claims he's nothing to hide. Despite previously fighting the proposal to make the documents public, the US president is now backing the vote to do so. That's not the whole story, though, because finally he has to sign off on the release. But he called for an investigation into certain people, certain Democrats, which means that those particular files could not be released because they're part of an ongoing investigation. Also, his party, do they not run the Senate? And the Senate is a bit cold on whether or not they are going to release those files or not. And then ultimately he has to sign it. What is your views on zoos? I said it before in the program. I am an animal lover, don't get me wrong, but it's not like I'm not a glue myself to the footpath, don't eat meat animal lover. But I was recently at a zoo and I just couldn't understand what the point of it was. It was a nice enough day out. There were certain animals that sort of thrive in that environment and there were others that you could see the absolute boredom, distress in their faces. They were just lying there dead, almost. They appeared to be dead. And I just couldn't really see the point of it. And it's not a trip I'll be making again, to be honest with you. I stopped going to circuses when they had animals in it because, you know, there's elephants and they were being, you know, these big glorious animals being made to stand on their hind legs or with one foot in the air. And it's, as I say, I'm not OTT member of Pieta. Is it Pieta? Peter? Or anything like that there. It's just I was not comfortable seeing the animals in that situation and I wasn't terribly comfortable with seeing many of the animals in a zoo situation because I just didn't think they should be there. And you know what? If that means that they're not on the planet at all, well, then maybe that's natural selection because being shoved in a pile of grass in a city in Ireland looking miserable, is that an existence at all? Or maybe if that's the difference between the animals being around and extinct, I don't know what the right answer to that is. But anyway, separate to that, a number of critically endangered species were among the 41 animals that died at Dublin Zoo during 2024. That represents a 64% increase in mortality compared to the previous year. Two Asian elephants, what are they doing in Ireland? A zebra also doesn't belong here, and two grey wolves were among the animals that died at the zoo last year, along with a female chimpanzee. Again, it should be swinging in the branches of a country far from here. And two Borneo orangutans. Again, not belong to this environment. A female Siberian tiger called Tundra was euthanized last December following a decline in her condition. The public will still be able to see her on display, though, as her skin and skeleton were preserved, which is lovely, aren't it? The poor Siberian tiger, they had to kill it because it was deteriorating, but they took her bits and pieces so you can still go down and have a look at her in her state. But anyway, it's not something I'd campaign on, or I don't know, would I even sign a petition? It's just something I'm not terribly comfortable with. Anyway, this microphone, does this microphone sound normal to you? Does it? There's a funny sound off it, maybe. It's my headphones. Okay, we're joined on the programme now by Reverend David Latimer, who's the former minister of First Derry and Monaria Presbyterian Church. Reverend, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Greg. Very, very nice to be with you again. Good to see you.
Indeed, and you too. We see in a statement released that, from Reverend Dr. Dave Allen, the acting clerk of the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church. And it reads, by now you may have heard the distressing news reports about serious safeguarding failings in the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. And then he goes on to share some things about that. We failed to make referrals to statutory authorities when they were required. We did not respond adequately to concerns expressed to us about individuals and congregations and so on. Were you surprised, or perhaps did you have foreknowledge that this story was going to break as it might?
Greg, there was no foreknowledge. This storm swept throughout the island with great surprise, and it has shocked and distressed me. I listened, you know, with with disbelief to the information that was provided during the press conference last Wednesday from Belfast, and that was shocking. And then since then, of course, we've had the letter you referred to, the acting clerk sent out to congregations. It was a lengthy letter, unnecessarily long, I felt. And I've been speaking with some elders from the church on both sides of the border. And really, one elder said to me it was toothless. Another said in the north here it was bland. And someone else said nothing new to share. So really, it was a letter that maybe has led people to believe, is there something a wee bit more here than what we're led to believe that there actually is? So it's so messy. And now with the police being introduced into the arena, we can only hope that this can be contained and that it can be resolved quickly for the good of the denomination and for the good of the victims.
Yes, and whilst the investigation is into the handling of past safeguarding issues, it is very current. Between 2009 and 2021 and an additional case in 2022. The PSNI say the number is small at this time, but expect other people to come forward. Like, it's hard to imagine any religious organisation wouldn't have seen what has been going on for generations in this country and would have thought, yeah, right, we really need to get our house in order here.
We do. The historic nature of this crisis, it now that it has been, it is in the public square, how this was kept under wraps for so long within a church, it really is not best practice. I kind of think when I reflect on it, Greg, that the church maybe sees this as a small wound that needed little more than a sticking plaster, but this is not a small wound. An artery has ruptured and it's bleeding, and the bleeding cannot be stopped. And that's why, thank God, we have the door being opened, albeit slowly, I think, for external, credible professionals with experience in this arena to come in and to be allowed to open the lid of this box and drill down to see exactly where did this all go wrong? How did it last for so long? And how do we put it right?
But also, we don't really know necessarily what we are talking about, because there was an investigation. There are no specifics that I can see coming from the Presbyterian Church by way of statement, and there have been no interviews since. So as far as I'm aware, we don't actually really know the nature of these safeguarding issues. Is it relating to adults? Is it relating to children? Yeah. Is it to do with abuse? Is it to do with bullying? Is it, you know, we really don't know, as far as I'm aware, sorry, and pardon my ignorance, reference if I've missed it, what this is about.
Yeah, I think that's the boat that we're all in. The mystery of this just continues to deepen, and it must be serious, Greg, when you consider that the moderator of the General Assembly stepped down because of this. Now, it really suggests that there has been a big cover up, and that maybe people are preparing the way for the news that will have to be shared. But it is quite unprecedented that a moderator should step down during his year of office. But then, of course, the current moderator was, from 2008 up until his appointment as moderator in June, he was in the chair in the top room, if you like. He began in 2008 as deputy clerk and then progressed to become clerk of the General Assembly. So really, all of this was happening on his watch, and possibly that has been influential in him having to make that very, very difficult decision and step down as moderator.
Yes, and he was in with us just a couple of short weeks ago. And, I mean, obviously there'd be no tells, but He was enjoying his year. He was enjoying his visit here. There was certainly nothing to indicate that this this bombshell was about to drop, Reverend.
That is quite right. I'm conscious of the huge army of volunteers. They're within every church, but given the microscopes sort of focused on the Presbyterian Church across the island of Ireland, I'm sort of conscious that the huge army of volunteers, loyal and faithful in their work, will feel the guilt, and yet they shouldn't.
Well, can we talk a little bit more about that? Because, of course, Reverend, you and I are in the same situation here, in that we don't know who the victims are, the number of victims, and indeed what they may be victims of, if the truth be told. We know the frame of it, and ultimately that is where our concerns are at this point. But I do want to talk about the church more generally. It is a sizable church, but also small enough that it is a community. It straddles both sides of the border. Like all religions, you know, it has people that are incredibly devout and also very trusting. And this news will feel like a breach of their confidence, their trust. It will feel like the rug has been pulled from them. If they have been wobbling on their faith for whatever reason, it might be that which tips them over. So the waves from this, the epicenter, of course, is the victims. But the waves of this throughout the church, at least until we get some sense of truly what's going on, this is going to affect the congregation personally, or at least certainly, you know, large parts of that congregation.
Yes, yes. This is creating a wobble within the confidence that we all have of the Presbyterian Church, because you kind of think the church is immune from this sort of thing. But wherever you have people, people can be unpredictable, and people are frail, and people make mistakes. And really, once that happens, you need to put your hands up. Otherwise, the ripples go wider. Now, there probably hasn't been sufficient accountability from the church hierarchy about this story. And the letter I referred to that was read on Sunday, it doesn't clear the air. And you know, the church is very good at praying, and we need prayers when life starts to get a wee bit messy, Greg. But I kind of think a prayer and a platitude, which is the typical things that the church really has within its arsenal to offer to people in when they need it, there's something more needed than that. You mentioned earlier about the church putting its house in order. Dr. King, I'm a great fan of Martin Luther King Jr. My goodness, he died early, but what a legacy of wisdom he has left behind. But he said, our lives begin to end the day we stay silent about things that matter. Now, nothing matters more than resolving this situation swiftly, so that people who have been loyal and who are currently shaking, understandably, given the storm that's waging around the church, to ensure that that army of volunteers and those faithful members continue coming to the pews, this thing has to be sorted. The time for talking is over, and therefore I'm pleased that it would appear the church is recognizing it needs external help. And the sooner that external help is made available and we're aware of exactly what has happened, people hopefully will start to recover confidence and trust in the church. But there's a mountain to climb. This thing doesn't happen and suddenly you wave a wand and everything is good. There's clearly no ready-made mix and stir formula to make things good again. It's going to have to be a journey where trust is built, and where people, families and with children, you know, parents and guardians leaving their children at the church for different organizations and events. People need to know their children are going to be safe. And at the moment, there's a question mark over that. Yet I must add, the vast majority of people are first class, doing amazing work, and they need to be protected and they need to be defended.
Yes, and this needs to be seen to be open and transparent. I believe the church needs to release any information that it can and not hide behind the fact, well, we can't say anything now because a criminal investigation is ongoing. I think, you know, we could get more information or reassurance. Also, too, you know, the charities regulator has statutory powers to come in and investigate as well. So that could be another level of scrutiny. I just think in this day and age, and because these allegations are really quite recent, and there are bits of information being dripped here and there, as much as is possible to protect, obviously, any victims and the integrity investigation, other than that, everything needs at this point to be out into the open. If I could even extend your metaphor, the sticky plaster needs to be ripped off, because I don't think anything can heal until such time as that's all done, Reverend.
No, I kind of think I would like to say something, Greg, to the people who are just who are just stunned and who are starting to ask questions. Is this the church? What has happened to the church? Do I want to belong to this church? And I would want to say to them that it is never too late for any institution or any individual to make amends and to put right what has gone wrong. This is not a time for us to give up. This is a moment, I think, for Presbyterians quietly to inwardly believe we need to get up, and somehow we need to go back. And we need to maybe begin again. The church can learn lessons from this and become a bit more compassionate and caring, because I feel maybe in a sense it has become quite authoritarian and it sort of engages in control. And that's, democracy is at the heart of the Presbyterian Church, wherever it is located. We pride ourselves in democracy, and yet over recent times, it would appear that democracy is being diluted, intentionally, maybe not. But we got to get back to recognizing it's the people that are at the center of the church, and it's the people that are the church, and the hierarchy are just part of that institution.
But just, I must ask you then, and it's a valid call, of course, but you're almost asking for turkeys to vote for Christmas here. You know, it is the same people that you are calling on to change or to reform are the very same people that are ultimately responsible for the church you described right now. So unless they have a dramatic change of heart, how does this different vision of the church come to pass?
I'm sort of minded of those who have an addiction to alcohol and who could be probably describe themselves as alcoholics, and you want to help the alcoholic. But until the alcoholic acknowledges they need the help, you feel quite helpless. And I feel that's where the church hierarchy is at the moment. They maybe don't think they've done something terribly wrong. The penny needs to drop, Greg, and they need to appreciate that this is a massive crises that they have created, and therefore they're unable to resolve it by themselves. Come in from wherever to help us recover the situation and to get to the very heart of it, so that this storm will pass and we can start to allow people to breathe again throughout the church who are faithful and in the pews week after week across the island.
Thank you for all of your time, Reverend David Latimer, former minister of First Derry and Monrea Presbyterian Church. Thank you for your time.
You're very welcome.
Look
Greg.
After yourself. Thank you so much, David. Right, by the way, you can seek out support if you're in Northern Ireland, by the way, and you're affected by that story, either in terms of affected by that story or it has triggered some sort of situation on you. I only have the Gardaí are there, by the way, because this church is on both sides of the border. But the Victim Support Northern Ireland, 048 9013 0405, that's actually a number you can dial from the Republic as well, 048 9013 0405, belfast@victimssupport.org.uk. there's a FOIL office there as well, foil@victimssupportni.org.uk. Domestic and Sexual Abuse Helpline in Northern Ireland, 0808 802 1414. And just numbers in the Republic, of course, you can contact Childline on 1-800-666-666, the Gardaí on 999112, or your local 24-hour number as well. As I say, it's possible there are personal people listening, and that is evoking something within. As the reference said there, everything needs to be on the table now from the church or any organisation, really. Now, members of the community of the Letterkenny and Surrounds are invited to a public information day entitled Letterkenny Investing in the Future. It's taking place on Wednesday, this Wednesday, tomorrow, in the Radisson Blue Hotel Letterkenny, and it runs from 3 to 7pm. It's organised by the council. The HSE, ATU Donegal and Donegal ETB are also involved, providing updates on major planned projects and investment in Letterkenny. So some of the topics, transport and regeneration initiatives, not controversial at all. The developments at Letterkenny University Hospital, which we hope are still on track and positive. Planned projects at the ATU, which is a real diamond in the crown of Letterkenny. And education and training opportunities through Donegal ETB. The mayor of the Letterkenny Milford Municipal District is Councillor Kieran Brogan, and he is with me now. Kieran, an important meeting would be normally how I would start these conversations, but then what I'm getting back from listeners often is that, you know, they get involved in these sort of things and then the voices don't feel like they're being heard. Do you understand that little bit of scepticism, but also would you still encourage people to go along?
I think it's very, very important, Greg, that people come along to this public information evening. It's something that I've asked Donegal County Council and the ATU and the HSE all to come together to share the investment, first of all, that's going into Letterkenny at the minute. I think the relevant agencies have never been working closer together and better together, and we're all stronger together. And if one only looks at the huge investment of the 110-bed new community and nursing unit that's well advanced to construction at this stage. We all know the success recently of the surgical hub and the ambulatory unit at Letterkenny and the control plant development control plan that's ongoing for the hospital, which will include an additional 78 beds at the University Hospital in Letterkenny. From a council perspective, we have the investment recently of the over $7 million for the courthouse project. A tourism and culture centre that will make a huge difference to the centre of the town. And then we have the recently public consultation around the whole cathedral quarter, and it's projects that we talked about for a long time, but we now as a council have funding for that. And of course the Market Square, which hopefully we'll see the announcement or the appointment of a contractor in the coming weeks. So and then you move on then to the ATU, which is, you have the new library ongoing at the moment. The construction is happening there at the minute. It's $25 million plus. This new sports complex at Knocknamona, out for tender at the moment, probably in around $20 million. That'll be a real game changer for that whole area of Knocknamona, and indeed a huge attraction for students coming to Donegal in the northwest. And then, of course, we have Minister James Lawless coming to Donegal next week again to turn and confirm the new veterinary college, which Minister McConnell Logue was very much involved in delivering for Donegal. It's the first time ever outside of Dublin that we have a veterinary college in this country, and I suppose a county that depends very, very much on the whole area of agriculture. I think it'll be a huge benefit to the whole of the Northwest and to the region. So I think it's important, and I've always felt in the past that sometimes we don't share enough information. And then, of course, the ETB has played a huge role over the years in upskilling and reskilling many people. And now, for the first time ever, outside of Dublin, that we have the ETB and the ATU coming together and the new apprenticeships. And that work is ongoing as well, out in Drumahoe as well. Which you'll see the new metal fabrication, the new refrigeration course, and of course the electrical apprenticeships as well in Killybegs. So I've never seen as much work happening, and they're coming together and doing as much as they can to provide as much opportunity for all the young people of this area. And I suppose going back over the years and the many challenges we've had here in the area of employment, it was about trying to retain and maintain as many of our own talent within this region so that they would have the equal opportunities. And I think people coming in today to make their contribution to this is important. And I suppose we all know the conversations around the traffic and the traffic congestion and the talk about the solutions for that. And some of the solutions we have for that is the Northern Relief Road, known better as the Whitey Hall Road. There's an amendment to the Part 8 planning for that that will be on public display as well. And it's important that people in that Whitey Hall Lane car and people in the wider area see that firsthand.
Do you know, it's funny, as you list things off there, you know, there is so much, there is so much positive stuff ongoing. Even the fact that we were speaking to the responsible minister yesterday, the expansion of TCS to look after the auto-enrolment pension, and, you know, foreign direct investment companies in here seem quite happy and are retaining jobs for the most part. And, you know, there's just an awful lot of positivity going on there then with the Indigenous small and medium enterprise. And it's ever made it so more important that we make sure we don't be doing silly little things to damage any of this progress, really, when you list it as you do.
I think we've come on a long way, Greg, in Letterkenny and in Donegal, the Northwest, over the years. You know, if one looks back at the many challenges we've had, you know, going back to the textile industry, you lost the jobs in Fruit of the Loom, you lost the jobs in Unify, and people thought we would never recover from that. And I think people like the ETB and the ATU done huge work over the years in producing the graduates to meet the needs of all the foreign direct investment companies that we have. And the one clear message that you'll get from all the companies that we have here in Letterkenny is that the talent we have here in the Northwest is second to none. And they maintain that, you know, that's the strength we had. And I remember Darren McCarthy, who's the CEO of Fintrough, saying that when he came to the Northwest, he came here because of the talent that we have in the Northwest. So I think the people, the workforce, deserve great credit as well. Yeah. And I think we have that in abundance. And again, this is taking things on to another level. And it's important that people do go in, get fully informed of all the investment and all the different projects that's happened, and feed into that as well, because I think that's very, very important.
All right, it's tomorrow in the Radisson Blue Hotel, Letterkenny, between 3 and 7pm. Thanks very much for joining us. That's Mayor Councillor Kieran Brogan, the Mayor of the Letterkenny Milford Municipal District. Thanks for your comments coming in so far this morning on a range of issues. I'll be getting to those shortly. But the weather, a mix of sunny spells and scattered showers. Some of the showers will be heavy with a chance of hail becoming breezy, with west to northwest winds increasing moderate to fresh and gusty, veering northerly later and becoming strong at times across the region. Temperature 6 to 9 degrees, but it feels colder. But what does the weather have in store for us over the next couple of days and into the weekend? It would seem that we're going to get a bit of a blast from the Arctic for a couple of days before weather turns relatively milder again. But what do I know? Let's go to Kenneth Conlon, founder of the Donegal Weather Channel. Good morning, Kenneth.
Good morning, Greg.
Nice to have you on the show. Right, so this is our first real taste of winter 2025-2026. So what can we expect across the northwest over the next few days?
I suppose looking ahead, it's really tonight we start to see that colder air moving down across the country. It's an Arctic air mass, and we're going to see showers turn increasingly to sleet, hail, and then snows all over the higher ground. And there will be some snow too inland on lower elevations that could give some issues with ice and snow accumulations, but accumulations will generally be low.
But we know the hot spots, don't we? We, Kenneth, where you normally expect to see snow sitting, you're likely to see it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's like, I suppose, places like Bally, in and around Bally with Barnesmore Gap, Mina Roy, up around Errigal and places like that there, you're going to get probably snow lying there, mostly through tomorrow morning into probably Friday morning. A lot of the showers will occur, I suppose, into Wednesday morning, over much of Wednesday into Wednesday night and Thursday morning, and then kind of Thursday the showers ease off again. And then I suppose the coldest night this week is probably going to be Friday night. Temperatures could fall down to -3, -4. So ice could be a real issue then at that stage as well.
And what will it feel like? Will we have a wind with that driving that real feel down?
Yeah, so there will be quite a wind chill with that as well. So it could actually feel like more like -5, -6 in a northerly wind. So it will feel a lot colder than it is. But I suppose the main thing is that if you're going out to wrap up, and there's no weather warnings in place at the minute, but there is potentially going to be, I'd say, a snow and ice warning issued for northwestern counties and possibly parts of Northern Ireland as well over the next couple of hours.
Yeah, it'd be great to see, I think, Kenneth, if we got more local involvement in those weather warnings. You know yourself, and you've mentioned it, there's going to be parts of Donegal, potentially, you know, they'll not see a flake and it won't really feel cold. And then others whereby, you know, real caution required in terms of driving and what have you. You know, these blanket warnings, they're not really nuanced enough, even for a county as big as Donegal.
Yeah, you'd see that in a lot of counties, well, especially the likes of Donegal, maybe Cork, and places even like Kerry, like even like during big wind events, like you might see like southern parts of Donegal or northern parts of Donegal, the wind threshold could be into an orange or red one, whereas maybe the southern part of the county winds might be a lot lower, so it mightn't even reach that threshold. But I think there is scope there on a national level as well for maybe the weather warnings to be relooked at, but it doesn't look like anything's going to be done about that anytime soon from what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think you're right. So so synopsis, really, you don't need to stock up on bread.
No, I wouldn't be stocking up on bread. Okay, like it's not going to be anything that we haven't seen before. The amounts will be relatively low, but obviously there still is going to be the risk of icy conditions. So do take good care out in the roads,
yeah, for sure,
and on the footpaths.
And don't presume a road is safe just because the gritters have been out, because you never know the way the nature of weather. It's just not that predictable. And then from Friday into the weekend, is it milder, more unsettled? Relatively milder, yeah, compared to.
So Friday morning will start off fairly cold and with icy conditions, and then through, I suppose, the late morning and afternoon, it is going to become cloudy with some rain and drizzle over that evening and night. But overall, the weekend for Donegal, it doesn't look too bad. Saturday, there will be a lot of drier weather, and then Sunday, there will be a lot of dry weather as well with some sunshine. Just going back to the point there that you made as well about road temperatures, yeah, and ice and roads, sometimes you can get an air temperature of around 3-4 degrees. But sometimes the ground temperature can be much lower and can lead to ice freezing on the surface. So that is a real danger as well. We've actually seen that previously. I'd say you might remember, there was one morning a few years ago, Greg, where air temperatures were actually up around 3 or 4 degrees. Mm. And I think the whole road from Ballyshannon down to Killybegs was just pure black ice.
Like
so there is that danger as well.
Of course, and also to the grit and salt, its impact is on contact. It doesn't have a lasting impact really per se either. So a road gritted or salted at 6:30, it's at that time really it's most effective. So we just have to be extra careful and make sure we get all where we're going safe. Kenneth, thanks very much indeed.
That's no problem, Greg. Thank
you
very much.
Look after yourself. Bye-bye. Kenneth Conlon there, founder of the Donegal Weather Channel, and you can check him out on social media as well. I believe they've got a website, just in case you wanted to keep updated. But it's not to say, listen, we're not here saying, we're in for an awful spell of weather per se, but because it's the sort of first blast of winter, it does make it a little bit more notable. So don't be stealing all my bread. I just want to go in and get a loaf. You know what I mean? It's not that bad. Right, a caller says, would it be better if we worried more about the victims than keeping people coming to the church? As both me and the Reverend were at pains, or certainly I was, I can't speak on behalf of the Reverend, to point out that first and foremost, primarily, it is the victims, and they are front and centre, and I said that really quite clearly. But we also have to understand there are very good people, the absolute majority of people, that when they hear this news are shook by it and affected by it, and you have to have that broader conversation as well. Regarding control and hierarchy in the church, same in the Catholic Church, it's unbelievable the control they have over schools. What about Lower Main Street of Letterkenny? It's an eyesore, an embarrassment to see it in such decay. I'm not from Letterkenny, right? But as long as I've been in this building, we've had the same conversations about Lower Main Street. And what I don't understand is why no one's gone in there and invested a billion or whatever it might be, multiples of million, and just turn it into residential, a mix of residential and business. I mean, the town doesn't stop at a certain point, you know. In fact, the flatter parts you'd think would even potentially be more, could potentially be more attractive. You know, there are other flat parts of it, don't get me wrong. But my point being is that I don't understand why it's been allowed to get into the state, as some people feel it has. Greg, in relation to the money being spent on HSC agency staff, I'm with the HSC for nearly 30 years in admin. Most people want permanent posts, but the HSC have not approved enough WTE posts nationally by whoever holds the purse strings in Dublin. So they hide staff by recruiting them through agencies. They hire them. It costs the HSEs twice as much money to do so. The union have been fighting for years with HSE management to make posts permanent. It's an absolute mess. I worked with three agency staff last year. And I know, you know, I would have spoken in the past to people, say, for instance, in higher grade posts in the hospital, say, for instance, involved in, you know, the delivery of really important care, as everyone is, don't get me wrong. And it's a particular concern they would have in terms of agency staff in that area. The thing is though, caller, and square this circle for me, that apparently there's 3,700 permanent posts that aren't filled. And you say the HSE aren't improving permanent posts. Again, that just leaves me a little bit curious.